Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Sid Schwartz, one of the most innovative thinkers in the Jewish world today, whose latest project is as creator and director of the Clergy Leadership Incubator. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our new Shinshinim, Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach. That means happy holiday, and in truth, this is a time of great joy for Jews. This week we are celebrating Sukkot, actually my favorite Jewish festival, mostly because it isn't the high holidays. Now, in fact, I love Sukkot because of the outdoor quality of it, the emphasis on family, friends, guests, and enjoying life, and its central theme of gratitude, which underlies so much of all that's good about religion in general and Judaism in specific. Allow me to elaborate. Sukkot is the 8-day-long harvest festival commemorating a holiday that was one of the truly ancient ones on our very complicated Jewish calendar. In biblical times, Sukkot, called Sukkot by Orthodox Jews, was referred to as Hechag, the holiday, as though it were the only festival. Likely it was the most observed of all of them that are ordained in the Torah. Sukkot is the Jewish harvest festival during which we build tabernacles, little huts outside the house. We decorate them with fruits and vegetables and eat and even sleep over the course of the holiday in them. It's called Zman Simchatenu, the season of our joy, and it is filled with food, friends, and music, as well as rituals that pay tribute to our reliance upon God for the many good things in our lives. Sukkot's Jewish Thanksgiving. In fact, the American holiday of Thanksgiving was based by the Puritans on the biblical Feast of Tabernacles, or booths, established in the Torah. It was particularly important for our ancestors, whose whole lives were connected to agricultural production, farming, herding, and tending orchards and vineyards. A good harvest meant a healthy, safe winter. It was something for which to be truly grateful. The reason Sukkot was the most observed of all ancient Jewish festivals was likely because of the time of year in which it falls. While the Torah specifies 3 separate pilgrimage festivals in which the ancient Israelites were to travel to Jerusalem to make offerings to God, Passover in the spring, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks in the early summer, and Sukkot in the autumn, there must have been major challenges to farmers inherent on walking to Jerusalem for the first 2 of those holidays. Springtime, when Passover occurs, is a time of planting, weeding, fertilizing, doing all the hard work that eventually, we hope, results in a good crop. Early summer, when Shavuot falls, is the time of the first fruits and the early barley crop, which had to be harvested. But there are many other crops growing and needing to be tended in the diverse Mediterranean agriculture of Israel. But Sukkot comes in the fall. All the crop yields are complete. The harvest is in. Generally speaking, it is a time of plenty, an easier time to take a week to travel to the capital and celebrate. Sukkot must have been the time when the greatest crowds arrived in Jerusalem, bringing their agricultural bounty, making sacrificial offerings, but enjoying feasts every night of the festival. The temporary huts they built, the Sukkot they erected, would have been much like the huts that they used when they stayed in the fields near the crops when they were doing the harvesting. It was a time of great joy and celebration, of food, drink, friendship, conviviality. And it still is. Sukkot is when you are commanded to invite guests to your own sukkah, reflecting the very structure of a sukkah, open on at least one side so that visitors see immediately their welcome in. In addition to the ritual commandments of sitting in the sukkah and waving the lulav and etrog, the 4 species with which we celebrate the festival, palm, willow, myrtle, and citron, we symbolize the agricultural nature of the holiday, but we also complete the great commandment of hachnasat orchim, welcoming guests. There's a lovely little Yiddish tune about the sukkah called Asukkale, by the oddly named duo of Suki and Ding.
Asikele a kleine vom Breitalach gemeine hab ich mir asikele gemach badekte medach mit a besseres Sitze ich mir in Sikkele Bana Badekte Mida Mit a bissel Schad Sitze ich mir in Sikkele Bana doch die Spalten in die lächterlich sei löschen sich viel es ist mir achidisch wie ich mach mir kidisch in die lächterlich sei brennen ganz still Es ist mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kidisch, in die Lefterle, sei brennen ganz still. Sei nicht kanal, in hab nicht kan zahn, soll dir die nicht sein Bang Es ist schon gut bald 2000 Jahre in die Sikkele sie steigt noch ganz lang Es ist schon gut
That was the pretty little song Asukele for the Holiday of Booths this week. By the way, in Europe, there were homes that were built with a room that had a retractable roof so that it could be turned into a kind of interior sukkah for the festival, an inside-the-house hut. By Jewish law, a sukkah cannot have more than two permanent walls, so these interior sukkahs must have made some accommodation by constructing extra walls inside. But it speaks to the level of commitment to this holiday and to being Jewishly observant that whole homes were designed with a sukkah, used just 8 days a year, in mind. It's also true that some of us only use our living rooms or formal dining rooms that often in life, but it's when we have guests. Speaking of guests, on Sukkot we are also symbolically to welcome our ancestors to join us in the sukkah, our homemade tabernacle. These guests are called ushpizin, exalted guests. They include the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, as well as Moses, Aaron, and King David. It's a nice group. The more egalitarian streams of Judaism also welcome the matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, and biblical figures, Miriam and Deborah, as well. I invite to my meal the exalted guests, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Aaron, and David. May it please you, Abraham, my exalted guests, that all the other exalted guests dwell with me and with you, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Aaron, and David. On each day, a different one of the seven is singled out in order. So invite guests, real and imaginary, for this holiday to share the joy of the season of gratitude. You may have also noticed this morning that I have my traditional Sukkot cold, and it's changed my voice into something much huskier and hopefully more radio-y. Anyway, I hope you have a healthy and wonderful and joyous Sukkot. Our guest this morning is one of the most creative and innovative people working in the Jewish world today. Rabbi Sid Schwartz's latest project is the Clergy Leadership Incubator. Find out what that is, why it's important, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Tango, oh, tango, oh, Join your voice with renowned Jewish singer Billy Jonas on Sunday, October 8th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Tucson J. Sing, dance, and celebrate the holiday of Sukkot with the whole family. Billy Jonas has been entertaining the world with his funky folk music for years. Join the fun with Billy Jonas on Sunday, October 8th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Tucson J. Tickets include a light dinner and a PJ Library story. For tickets and more information, visit TucsonJCC.org or call 520-299-3000.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Sid Schwartz is one of the most innovative and visionary rabbis involved in working in the religious world today. He is the, I guess, the genius behind the Clergy Leadership Incubator, which has now completed two cohorts, going to a third. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much, Sam.
So you've had a fascinating career, written books about the future of the Jewish community. What led you to move to working specifically in this way with clergy and in this kind of model?
I guess I've got to take a step back. Back in the late 80s, I founded a synagogue, a Dat Shalom, the Reconstruction Synagogue in Bethesda, Maryland.
Right, in the D.C. area, right?
I used it as a kind of a laboratory to try and implement a lot of the things that I've been teaching about before. And when I stepped down from actively leading that congregation, I started doing a lot of work around the country with congregations, trying to move them to a new paradigm, which I described in my first book, Finding a Spiritual Home. Having done a lot of work with synagogues and boards, with seminaries, it became clear to me that the most important change agent in any congregation has to be the rabbi, its spiritual leader. And remarkably, across the board, now working with almost a dozen seminaries from Jewish Renewal to Orthodox, almost to an institution, they don't provide what I think is a critical training that rabbis need today, and that is how to be agents of change. There are a lot of other things rabbis need to know, and I don't envy rabbinical school deans that have to juggle how to teach rabbis everything they need to know in 5 or 6 years. And yet, to the extent that the institution and the paradigm that evolved in the post-World War II era that still are prominent in the American Jewish community, we know that those models no longer work, and rabbis themselves are frustrated with not having the skill set to move them to a new paradigm. And that's really where we've focused our work with the Clergy Leadership Incubator, which we call CLI, which is an acronym for the Hebrew term for clergy, Clay Kodesh.
Clay Kodesh, right. Vessels of Holiness. It's a very different religious world today, and while larger institutions sometimes have a hard time changing to meet that, it seems that like every 5 years, the rabbinate seems quite different. Is that just my imagination?
I would say with regard to synagogues, welcome to the 21st century. There's virtually no field or enterprise in America today that's not experiencing change at a pace which was unheard of 20 years ago. And it requires a level of flexibility and creativity and imagination. You know, whether you're a journalist today or in a corporate setting or in a nonprofit setting, rabbis are no different. So it's clear that you need to be nimble, and it is true that larger institutions have a harder time changing quickly. One of the things that we're seeing happening on the landscape is a bubbling up of a lot of startup congregations that are actually trying to reinvent what it means to be a spiritual community. And I think a lot of these communities are giving mainstream synagogues run for their money. And we've taken a lot of the lessons from those startup places and have woven it very deeply into the fabric of what we're doing with CLI.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Sid Schwartz about transforming rabbis and the Jewish world when we come back in just a few moments here on Two Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking about this remarkable trip you took, a reunion trip with campers and friends that you took to Russia long ago, and now you went to Odessa. We started talking about Odessa and the Yiddish culture there.
Right.
Which is so extraordinary, actually.
Odessa is sort of a who's who of both Yiddish literature and Zionist thought. And there's a big street called the Street of the Jews, which is right downtown. And on it lived, and there are plaques or statues or monuments to the following people, among others. And I'm sure I've forgotten a few. Jabotinsky, Chernyakhovsky, Shalom Aleichem, Isaac Babel, and Mendel Mochersvorim, who's like the grandfather of all Yiddish literature and one of the great pioneers of early Hebrew literature as well. So, I mean, imagine what an intellectual ferment there was in the second half of the 19th century in Odessa, where all these guys were living and writing and speaking and creating really the foundation for what would become the response of Jews throughout the Tsarist Empire, not only in Odessa, to the horrible pogroms of the 1880s and the May laws that were passed in the wake of those pogroms. Because of this stellar list of Odessa Jews, there was an intellectual framework arguing go to Israel, and there was an intellectual framework arguing go to the Golden of Medina, go to America. And people went in both directions. And Odessa was a port, so it was easy to get out by boat to anywhere else. But the fact, I mean, our group found it really mind-boggling that so many big names in Jewish history, and particularly in the history of Zionist thought, lived in the same relatively small city at the same time, within the same half century. Today, I mean, this would be the logical next question, is what's left?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So what's left are two functioning synagogues and possibly a third. This wasn't so clear. Or a minyan that meets in some room somewhere, but it's progressive or reform or something non-Orthodox. There's a mainstream Orthodox synagogue. There's a Chabad synagogue. And somewhere there's a reform minyan. There's two kosher restaurants, one of which is underneath the main synagogue. There are, again, this depends on who you ask, somewhere between 2,000 and 40,000 Jews there.
That's a big difference.
Right. Well, this turns out to be the case everywhere in the Ukraine. And when we get to Kiev, it's even more remarkable. But one of the people in our group who works for the Jewish Federation of Chicago actually went and met with the JDC and a couple of other Jewish agencies who are active in Odessa. She spent kind of half a day and was overwhelmed by the diversity of their programs, the richness, the multi-layering, and the fact that, at least in Odessa, different parts of the Jewish community actually cooperate with each other instead of compete with each other.
Imagine that. Might be a good lesson for us.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. Chag Sameach. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri, who are representing the Weintraub Israel Center and representing Israel here in America. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure. Chag Sameach. We're in the midst of Sukkot now, getting close to the end of the holiday season. So let's talk about something kind of central to Israeli society that not everybody really understands how important it is culturally, which is the institution of the army. When you guys go back to Israel, which is seems like a long time from now, but it's really next summer, you will both go into the army, as almost all young people do. Talk a little bit about how that works and what it means to you.
So I think that just the life path of an Israeli is a lot different than what we see with American teenagers we meet, because they graduate from high school and go straight to college or take a gap year, but then go to college. And for us Israelis, we graduate from high school, and then at 18, we can either do a year of service, which is what Tamir and I are doing.
That's what Shin Shinim is, doing Shin Shinim, a year of service. Right?
Yeah. Or you can just go straight to the army and serve in many different positions, some as combat soldiers, some as administrative work, and just a variety of positions. So Tamir and I will actually go to the army right after this. And my hope personally is to become an instructor for combat soldiers, to teach them how to shoot and things like that. And Tamir, I don't know what you're interested in. But.
Yeah. Tamir, so, tell us about it.
I actually don't know yet what I'm going to do in the army, but I can talk about the experience of having two sisters that served in the military. So one of them was very, very into her service, and she, as a girl, she's obligated to do 2.5 years, and she ended up doing 5 years of service.
Did she become an officer?
She became an officer.
Sure.
And it was very special to see how she was very connected to this, like to the IDF, because you feel like you've been protected your whole life and now it's your turn. And she felt like it was something that was really good for her personal growth, and also for the service of the country. And it was very touching to see that that the IDF can really bring people to their maximum and really improve and make you more mature and more responsible. So it's amazing. The process that my sisters went through after the army, it's amazing.
It also shapes a lot of your experience later in life. And if you're in the army, you're in a good unit, you go back to work with those people on Miluim and reserves regularly. And it gives you a leg up when you go to university and then in society, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you can and it's not a health or mental problem, and you try to like avoid doing your military service and you end up not doing it, it's going to be a lot harder to fit in society, because people kind of resent when you don't give back to your country. No one says you have to be a combat soldier. You can totally sit next to a desk for 3 years, but you kind of have to give yours to the society, and it's something that unites all Israelis.
Thank you guys so much. We will talk next week, and Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
We are now pleased and serene to bring you an occasional feature of Two Jewish, Two Haikus for Jews, returns from the Zen Judaism Department. Yom Kippur, forgive me, Lord, for the Mercedes and all that lobster. And is one Nobel Prize so much to ask from a child after all I've done? Those were two Haikus for Jews, our Zen Judaism segment. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us?
The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A guy builds a sukkah on his fire escape in New York. His landlord is so irate, he sues him and asks the judge to force the tenant to remove the illegal structure. The judge agrees with the landlord. I understand you have no permit for this unauthorized structure. That's true, Your Honor, says the guy, but it's a religious requirement. Well, that may very well be true, but the tabernacle structure must go. I order you to remove it within 10 days, declares Judge Feldman. Next case. You see, you only have to have the sukkah up for 8 days. Well, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and enjoy Sukkos. And now a word of Torah. This week we celebrate Simchat Torah, the wonderful festival, when we complete reading the Torah and start all over again at the very beginning. A very good place to start. Breishit, the very first Torah portion of the year, presents a unique challenge for every commentator. There is so much to say. Where to begin? Which is, of course, precisely the point. For Genesis is the beginning not only of the Torah, but of Judaism and all Western religion, including Christianity and Islam. It starts with the great theological creation in Breishit and the immortal, eternal words, Breishit bara Elohim, in the beginning God created. Those words are instantly recognizable, more famous than nearly all phrases in religious literature. But this celebrated commencement is actually a problem. You see, in Hebrew, the word breishit actually means at the beginning of, in the grammatical form called smichut, attached. It must therefore be followed by a noun, always. Yet here, at the very start of the beginning of the holiest and most ancient text in our tradition, it's followed instead by a verb, bara, created. That is, the first two words of the Torah don't agree. There's a grammatical error in the absolutely first place it could occur in the whole Bible, which is, of course, not only our Bible, but also the first text for Christianity, Islam, and all of Western civilization. What might this mistaken phrase mean? Commentators throughout history have engaged this question. Perhaps it means, at the beginning of time, God created. Perhaps it means, at the beginning of God's creation of the universe, God created. Perhaps it means at the beginning of the world God created. Well, you can come up with your own fix for this grammatical problem. So why don't we just correct it? Well, all traditional associations aside, we've had this text unchanged for at least 2,000 years. The Dead Sea Scrolls prove that. And then who are we to change the Torah and so on? There's a simple explanation that can open up the whole process of studying Torah and being an active Jew in a wonderful way. You see, if the very first words of Genesis require us to think and interact with the text, every passage of Torah must therefore be open to interpretation. That means we instantly become partners with God in the creation of Torah in every generation. Each of us must create her or his own understanding of the Torah, must make it meaningful to him or herself. Every one of us has to insert ourselves into this incredible book and find our own way. In the spaces between the words, each of us must create our own midrash, our own interpretation of Judaism that brings meaning and holiness to our lives. It's a remarkable invitation. Breshit bara Elohim. At the beginning of Torah, God created the process of Midrash and so invited us as partners to think, to learn, to teach, and to embrace our Judaism. That is really what Torah means, interactive learning, finding God through using the excellent minds we've been given to explore what a great text can mean in our lives and in this world. Breshit, the beginning. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Sid Schwartz, who has highlighted Jewish megatrends and constantly worked to innovate within the Jewish and religious world, will explain why we need a clergy leadership incubator and what is being accomplished with it when we come back in a moment right here on To Jewish.
Tongo, oh, tongo, oh.
Join your voice with renowned Jewish singer Billy Jonas on Sunday, October 8th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Tucson Jay. Sing, dance, and celebrate the holiday of Sukkot with the whole family. Billy Jonas has been entertaining the world with his funky folk music for years. Join the fun with Billy Jonas on Sunday, October 8th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Tucson Jay. Tickets include a light dinner and a PJ Library story. For tickets and more information, visit TucsonJCC.org or call 520-299-3000.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Among the 58 dead and 500 or so wounded in the horrifying massacre in Las Vegas last week were a number of Israelis and other Jewish victims. While full information on victims has not been released yet, this is the worst mass shooting in American history, passing the Orlando shooting in 2016, which killed more people than the Virginia Tech shooting in 2007. Fourth on the list of total people murdered in one shooting incident is the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. 47 weapons were discovered in the shooter's hotel room, along with 12 bump stocks to turn semi-automatic weapons into fully automatic weapons, essentially machine guns. No one knows why he did it, apparently, except for the fact that anyone who takes a whole bunch of guns and shoots large numbers of innocent people from a hotel room window is clearly mentally unbalanced. It also remains unclear why anyone in civilian life needs a bump stock to turn a semi-automatic weapon into a fully automatic weapon, or why these are even legal in the U.S., where fully automatic weapons are very difficult to come by. On the list of the 15 deadliest shooting incidents in American history, 9 have been perpetrated in the last 5 years. After each of these terrible atrocities, there is always vastly increased pressure on Congress to pass some sort of legislation limiting high-volume magazines or bump stocks. But it seems very unlikely anything will be accomplished this time either. Our profound sympathy goes out to the families of all of those murdered, and a Mishaberach prayer for healing to those who were wounded simply because they attended a music festival in Las Vegas. In happier news, the Nobel Prizes have been announced for 2017, and as usual, there are Jewish recipients. Michael Rosbach of Brandeis University, son of a cantor whose parents fled Nazi Germany, was one of three American scientists who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine, while two of the three recipients of the Nobel Prize for Physics are Jewish as well. The Nobel Prize for Medicine, awarded to Rosbach and two others, announced last week, was for their discoveries about molecular mechanisms controlling the body's daily rhythm and sleep. Jeffrey Hall of the University of Maine and Michael Young of Rockefeller University in New York joined Rosbach receiving the prize. They used fruit flies to isolate a gene that controls the rhythm of a living organism's daily life. The biological inner clocks regulate functions such as sleep, behavior, hormone levels, and body temperature. Rosbach, who is 74 years old, came to Brandeis in 1974. He is the Peter Gruber Endowed Chair in Neuroscience, professor of biology at the Jewish-founded non-sectarian school. This morning's unexpected announcement certainly affected my circadian rhythms, Rosbach said from Brandeis. I'm thrilled to join my colleagues in this recognition. I'm grateful to my colleagues at Brandeis and the unusual environment here that allows researchers to explore without boundaries while also engaging students in the process of discovery. This is a very special, unique university. Ross Bosch's parents were immigrants who fled Germany in 1938. His father was the cantor at Temple Ohave Shalom, a Reform synagogue in Brookline, not far from the Brandeis campus. And three American scientists received the Nobel Prize in Physics, including one who fled the Nazis with his parents and another whose grandparents were Polish immigrants. Rainer Weiss, professor at MIT, as well as Kip Thorne and Barry Barish of Caltech, were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery of gravitational waves predicted by Albert Einstein about a century ago. Gravitational waves are ripples in space and time that help scientists explore objects in space. Weiss won half the $1.1 million prize. Barish and Thorne split the other half. The Nobel winners and the late Ron Dreyer of Caltech founded an international collaboration of physicists and astronomers known as LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. In February of 2016, they announced they'd recorded gravitational waves emanating from a collision of a pair of black holes a billion, that's with a B, light years away. Dreyer died this year, but the Nobel Prize is not awarded posthumously. Weiss, who is 85, was born in Berlin to a Jewish father and non-Jewish mother. The family fled Berlin for Prague when Weiss was a baby because his dad was Jewish and a member of the Communist Party. After the Munich Agreement of 1938, the family left Prague for the U.S. Weiss got his doctorate from MIT and in 64 joined the faculty. Barish is from Omaha, grew up in L.A., the son of Lee and Harold Barish, children of Polish-Jewish immigrants to the U.S. He got his doctorate in 1962 from Berkeley and joined Caltech in 1963. While we Jews constitute significantly less than 1% of the population of the globe, we have won about 24% of all the Nobel Prizes ever awarded. This trend is continuing and astonishing. By the way, the Israeli city of Rishon LeZion has an avenue dedicated to honoring all Jewish Nobel laureates. The street called Tayelet Hatanei Pras Nobel, Nobel Laureates Promenade, has a monument with an attached plaque for each Nobel laureate. Well, they need to get some more up there after last week. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews round the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Sid Schwartz. He is the visionary rabbinical presence and leader of a fairly new program, the Clergy Incubator Program, which is working with rabbis and other spiritual leaders in developing new methods and new techniques and new ways of serving the Jewish world and I think the religious world in general. Rabbi Schwartz said, when I was growing up, rabbis used to joke about how the job was hatch'em, match'em, and dispatch'em. You know, that it was about birth rituals and bar mitzvah rituals and weddings and funerals. Those things still happen. So do services. So do all of the different Jewish holidays, educational experiences. And yet, rabbis are expected to do many different kinds of things today. What are the major transformational approaches that you have found, and what are the biggest surprises you found in the Clergy Incubator Program?
Well, it's true. There's no no one has taken anything off of the job description list of most rabbis. All those things that you and I grew up with are still expected of rabbis. But what I say to my rabbis is that the reality is that you can work in a congregation, work 40, 50, 60 hours a week. At the end of the week, feel that you still have left many tasks unattended. And after 40 years of good service, you will not have changed the institution one iota. Those things are all needed, and you will have touched the lives of people, and that's holy work. But one of the things that we're working with rabbis at doing is taking a step back, or if you will, have them take a step onto the balcony and take a look at the entire structure of what spiritual communities are and to think about what else they might be able to do. There are several principles that, you know, cut across that I think really may give you a better idea about the kind of changes that need to happen. Number one is synagogues need to be increasingly clear about their mission. 30 years ago, no synagogue gave a lot of thought to putting together a mission statement. But today, you need to make the case for what is the value added of a synagogue. People don't seem to need synagogues any longer. Many of the services that synagogues provide can be found or bought a la carte from private entrepreneurs, rabbis who kind of put up their own shingle. So synagogues have to be much clearer about their mission and what they're trying to accomplish. In addition, the whole notion of the rabbi doing everything from the top down no longer works. We're in an age of DIY culture, do-it-yourself. And among the things that rabbis need to learn from the startup and pop-up synagogues is that the more you empower lay people to take leadership roles in not only teaching and life cycle and social justice, those have happened for a while, but even in terms of leading services and doing things that previously were seen as the only in the province of the rabbi to do, the more you create that energy from the bottom up, the more dynamic community you create. And finally, I want to say that I am not at all pessimistic about the future of American synagogues. I wouldn't be doing this work if I thought synagogues were dead on arrival. I think today there is more need, more desire for compelling spiritual community than ever before. Given the fast pace of our society, the growth of the internet, the sense of being unconnected, the fact that people can brag about having 500 or 5,000 friends on Facebook and they can't find a single person with whom to have a deep and intimate conversation, or they can't find a person who actually going to come in and be with them at a time of need, these are the things that synagogues should be manifesting in prominent ways. So there's a desperate need for community, but it's got to be engaging of all people and not just serving the 5% of the members who are showing up week after week.
So, you know, part of the difference that we see is the increased kinds of communication, whether it's social media, it started with email, website, Instagram, you know, there's going to be a continuity of new, it's continually changing, right? That, again, means you don't kind of get to drop anything. I mean, as a rabbi, you still write a bulletin article, and yet you communicate in all these 400 other ways now. What does that do to the process? Each one of these is sort of a different form of communication. Rabbis are teachers and communicators. What does that do to that process for us?
Well, you know, every person who leaves an institution feels that they are irreplaceable and they have to be everywhere at once.
Of course, yes, naturally.
Part of the idea of empowering lay people is to say, maybe you don't have to do everything. One of the rabbis in my cohort that just graduated in June was very intent on trying to change the nature of his Shabbat morning service. It was a relatively new rabbi, and he knew that there were people who were regulars, the loyalists, who were coming, who would resist major changes to his service. So he wanted to create a second service in an alternative place, an alternative minyan, if you will, and try and create whole new models of how they might observe Shabbat. In order to make that happen, he needed to educate his leadership to say that he would be absent from his main service once a month to help create this new model of tefillah. Now, it's early in the experiment, but actually, we've done this with several other synagogues where it has happened very successfully. There's a synagogue out in Denver that created a second minyan that was led by the senior rabbi, and then the assistant rabbi started working there. And many of the innovations of the second service started to make its way into the main service and back and forth. And to me, that's healthy. To my mind, a synagogue needs to allow 1,000 flowers to bloom. And if the energy is not going to come from one person, it will come from another person. I think rabbis need to be much more flexible and realize that there's a tremendous amount of creativity and even genius that can come from people who are in your community if you just give them a license to roam with things.
You work primarily in the early parts of the clergy leadership incubator with rabbis who are fairly new in the field. You've extended it a little later. Is it easier to work with people who are just starting out, even though some are second career people?
It's a great question, Sam. Here's the tension. Clearly, rabbis early in their career are eager to learn things and do things in different ways. Once a rabbi is in the field for a longer period of time, they kind of say, this is who I am, this is what I do, this is how I do it, and there's not that much, it's harder to kind of change what's going to happen. But at the same time, as rabbis move through their career, when they get to their second and or third position, they have more confidence. They're oftentimes in larger institutions. They're better resource institutions, and more can happen. So we're now experimenting with kind of mixing it up and not just working with early career rabbis, but work with rabbis who are closer to their mid-career. The most interesting thing that's happened in a lot of the work that I've done in writing and speaking publicly about the challenges facing American synagogues is that very few rabbis challenge the analysis that I put out about why it is that the synagogue center that evolved in the 1950s and 60s is not working any longer. There's very little challenge to that analysis. The question that comes to me again and again from rabbis is, okay, we know we've got to change. Tell us how to do it. You know, what can we try? What can we do? And when rabbis start to get together, and the things that we spend most time on is how to have rabbis train their leadership that risk-taking is permissible. Because in most conventional synagogues, the cost-benefit ratio to taking a big risk on the part of a rabbi doesn't pay off because people are expecting things in a certain way. There's a certain amount of convention that people come to expect from their synagogue. And so if a rabbi is going to change something in a dramatic way, it's likely to annoy the people who are the most loyal to the institution with no guarantee that new constituencies will present themselves to take advantage of the new models. And so one of the things that I think we're learning from the whole entrepreneurial innovation sector in American society is take risks, take chances, and make sure your institution understands that the only way that you're going to keep your institution relevant is if you try new things. And it may be that 3 out of 4 will fail, but the fourth one will provide some kind of new energy to a community that desperately needs some new ideas.
Do you think that rabbis are trained to be risk averse? Or do you think our personalities tend to be, that tends to attract people who are not so willing to take chances?
Well, here's the interesting thing that we've learned. You know, many rabbis are drawn to the profession because they want to help people in times of joy and in times of crisis. They are great pastors. And pastors know how to hold people when they need to be held and to raise people up when they fall down. And oftentimes the skills that are necessary to be a change agent at an institution are actually different than being a pastor. Because the name of one well-known book is, move fast, break things, and the whole notion of upsetting the apple cart is almost a key idea of anyone who's an entrepreneur or innovator. And so rabbis need to kind of find out how do you do both. They can't stop being pastors, but they need to move into modalities where not everyone will be happy with changing the way Shabbat morning happens, or not everyone will be happy if you decide to go out on the front lines of some political issue. More and more institutions today are seeing that, given the time that we live in right now, that synagogues need to be on the front lines of social justice, and they want to see their congregations be out there. That's going to upset some people because not everyone will be in agreement. And rabbis are, walking a very fine line when they try and keep the program moving that they've inherited and they've been hired to do, but also trying to move the congregation in new directions.
What's the most surprising thing that has come out of the Clergy Leadership Incubator for you?
For me, the most surprising thing is that rabbis, the talent in the rabbinic pool, I think we're still fortunate that people of talent who love Judaism, love the Jewish people, are committed to the State of Israel, want to give people a way to lead more meaningful lives, are still being attracted to the rabbinate. And even though membership numbers are declining, there's still a tremendous amount of respect that Jews have for rabbis. I think as a common theme that I've been hearing is that the rabbis, as they move through the program, they are feeling so supported in terms of getting the courage to hear their own voices come forward about what is their vision. We start the whole program with having rabbis write their own vision statement and then seeing how they can move the program with their congregations in alignment with that vision. It's ironic that their rabbis are out in the field for, you know, a decade or more who've never actually crafted their own vision. They just say, tell me what to do. Lead services, teach a class, you know, visit the hospital, do a social action program here and there, run holiday services. That's not a vision. And so getting people, rabbis, to be visionary opens up tremendous wellsprings of creativity on the part of the rabbis who say, whoa, I was never asked before what my vision is for my rabbinate, what my vision is for my community. And once people start articulating that, they are motivated to kind of move their institution in that direction. And that leads to a breath of fresh air. I'll tell you a quick anecdote. At the end of the two-year program, we do surveys of the lay leaders in the institutions that the rabbis serve. And it's incredible to read the comments of these lay leaders to say, you know, that in a matter of a couple of years, they're seeing their rabbi really change in terms of how they carry themselves and how they speak and the kind of inspiration that they can put forward. And I think Jews are desperate to be inspired. I say to rabbis, you can't just be a rabbinic functionary. As important as all those tasks are, you need to be a visionary who inspires Jews to live, to be their best selves, and to fully flourish as human beings. And for them to understand that Judaism and their spiritual communities can help them be that is something that is actually kind of a whole new way of doing the rabbinate.
I'm delighted to have had you here, Sid. Thanks for a great visit on Too Jewish. If people want to find out more about the Clergy Leadership Incubator and about your work in general, where should they go?
The best website for the CLE program is cliforum.org. And to see more about my work, I'm at rabbisid.org.
Sid, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Sam.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Ron Kronish, a pioneer on interfaith work in Israel, author of the new book, The Other Peace Process, Interreligious Dialogue, A View from Jerusalem. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes, Top 10 in North America, or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes for the Festival of Simchat Torah. It's this coming Thursday night. The upbeat Torah Freilach, Sisu V'Simchu, rejoice and celebrate on Simchat Torah. May you have a Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Sukkot, of Shmini Atzeret, and of Simchat Torah, Moadim L'Simcha, and a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
בשמחת תורה, ותנו כבוד לתורה. סיסו וסימפו, 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 בשמחת תורה, כבוד לתורה, סיסו ושמחו בשמחת תורה, ותנו כבוד לתורה, סיסו ושמחו בשמחת תורה, ותנו כבוד לתורה, סיסו ושמחו.
besimchu, besimchat Torah, utnu kavod la Torah. Susu besimchu, besimchat Torah, utnu kavod la Torah. Susu besimchu, besimchat Torah, utnu kavod la Torah. Susu besimchu, besimchat Torah.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.